Save big money and start your spring project with help from Menards. We offer a huge selection of bonnie plants, veggies, and herbs to plant at home and grow yourself. Right now, all 4.5-inch bonnie plants are on sale through May 5th. Head to the Menards Garden Center to get your garden growing and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome to Dugout Study Hall, a remedial course in baseball stats and proud member of the Pitcherless Podcast Network. I'm your host and expert layman, Matt Goodwin, and I'm joined as usual by your fake baseball economist, Alexander Chase. On this episode, we'll look at recent call-ups, how to analyze the minor league data, and what major league stats to look at to help you understand what story all of it tells together. We'll also discuss the A's stadium situation and talk a little bit about billionaires. But before we get to all of that, Alexander, how you doing?
Hey, Matt. Not too bad today. How about yourself?
Pretty good. Got out on the golf course today. Although I did get, since we have to talk about weather, I did get rained out of the last two holes. Rained out is wrong. I got lightninged out of the last two holes, which is far more dire. So as much as it was disappointing, better than being struck by lightning.
Hey, I know a guy who played the round of his life during, you know, like a sideways thunderstorm and lightning. I mean, it didn't end great for him, but I think they move a movie about it, actually. It really is our duty here to inform the people about what the weather was like 7 or 8 days prior to whenever they listen to us.
Definitely.
And I think that's really important that we can provide them this service.
I'm trying to segue into it being relevant to the day's activities. But yes, somehow weather is always going to... Well, I mean, you know, listen, weather really dictates so much of what you can do, especially during the summer, so... I think it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Let's get started with our bell ringer, and I'm going to ask you this question. 'Tis the season for a lot of minor league movement, especially as we approach the trade deadline, maybe some people getting moved and some guys getting called up. So for you, who's been the most exciting call-up so far?
You want me to give you an answer that's based off of not just like the knee-jerk knuckleball emotion aspect, right?
Whatever really like floats your boat about the call-up so far, like the one guy that you're like, yes, I've been waiting for a long time, or yes, this person's exciting, or even maybe the other way around, like I didn't think much was going to happen, and they've come up and been really good, so I'm excited about them.
Okay, well, yeah, again. The wrong answer that I'm going to give you anyway is Mickey Janis, the knuckleballer that the Baltimore Orioles promoted. I was at his debut. It was really fun for my friend who's an Astros fan that was also there. But, you know, like, I think that's the sort of fun aspect of the game that has been one of like the funner things for me to kind of like be present.
Yeah,
for,
that's always awesome to be at a game when something cool happens.
I would say, though... in terms of like actual guys who have been called up this calendar year, not like the rookies from last year who like still have rookie status and are
right.
Yeah, they don't count. They don't count at all. There's a lot of really interesting dudes on that list. I would probably say, I don't know. I'm excited for what Jaron Duran can do thanks to his like minor league run. We're going to talk about him plenty.
Yes.
But Jazz Chisholm probably is the guy who I think, like, I guess I would call him more of a rookie because he might have played a bit last year, but his like being a thing is this year. So yeah. I'm gonna use that as my answer.
His being a thing is this year. That is true. His being a thing is this year. I think it's always very exciting when we start to get into the part where those like top 10, top 20, top 30 mm-hmm. prospects start making their debuts, and that's kind of gonna be the focus of what we talk about with this episode is looking at when they come to the majors, what can we learn about them from their minor league information? And then kind of what do we start looking at once they're in the major leagues to either support or maybe change the narrative. But before we get to the details of all of that, I would like to bring up the number of the week who's it's going to be about a different prospect that we're going to dive into a little bit more deeply. But that is number 15. And the reason that I bring up 15 is that Brandon Marsh For the Fangraphs prospect lists, he was ranked 15th preseason. So as of February of 2021, he was 15th. He's gotten the call. Talk to me a little bit about Brandon Marsh.
Brandon Marsh is a guy that I have always kind of not known enough about, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And today, like, I think a lot of the theme is going to be about what we don't know about these guys, but
sure.
He represents kind of like a couple different versions of, I feel like, how I've been ignorant about prospects in some different ways. Ignorant is a fun word to use here. Because, but yeah, you know, at first, you know, you see a guy who's putting up, over the course of like a full calendar year, about 10 home runs. Brandon Marsh's season high ever as a professional baseball player, which is what you are when you're in the minors, yes, is 10 home runs, which is what he did in 2018 across A and high A ball, over the course of, what is that, 127 games. 10 home runs, and 14 stolen bases that year. And he was striking out at that point in the rookie-ish, but not actually rookie ball. He was playing, you know, like 26% of the time. I don't know how you look at something like that and be like, yeah, that's my dude. I am ready to go to bat for him. And he's gotten better, obviously. We saw him play about, no, actually fewer games, but mostly in Double-A in 2019. And the strikeouts dropped, and he put up a 137 WRC plus in Double-A, which is good, because he's good competition there. And he's got some tools that are really easy to project. And I would say, like, over time, he's the sort of guy that, like, talk to people like Trevor Huth and people who are not Trevor Huth, and you start to get a picture for, like, what you would care about. He's tall. He's not strong yet, but he could be strong one day. He's currently fast. He'll probably be less fast one day, but that's a good way to get yourself in to a position that might matter.
Yeah, right. Opportunity, for sure.
So, yeah, he's a really interesting guy. I think people project him to be a pretty good defender. And then I think the question then is, like, okay, you start to learn about some stuff and, like, you're like, okay, is he actually good enough to contribute to the team right away if he's this high-ranked prospect? Well, the answer kind of is no in a lot of cases, right? I have a lot of doubts about a lot of guys that come up because typically people don't succeed immediately in Major League Baseball. So at this point, the sort of, like, ignorant I am about someone like him is the same sort of ignorant that everyone kind of should be. We don't know exactly what we're gonna get out of him.
He's
swiped the bag already, which is cool. He hasn't really hit any laser beams to use a technical term there, but I'm really interested in him as a case study that I'm gonna kind of be willing to follow up on and kind of, like, watch throughout the rest of the year. What kind of information do we get? How much does he fall in line with what we think we know about him?
What
do you know about Brandon Marsh to turn the tables here?
I don't know much about him. I know he's got he had a decent pedigree, a lot of tools, right? He was a 60 grade future value prospect. Anybody ranked in the top 20, you're talking about somebody who is expected to contribute at the major league level. So I think this is a good place and a good way for us to segue into basically the crux of what we're going to talk about here. With our case studies and our central question about how do we make sense of all of this? What information can we use from the minor leagues? How can we contextualize that so that it makes sense? And then once they're here and we do start getting that MLB data, what is it that we should be looking at maybe a little bit more closely right off the bat? I know some of this stuff takes a while for it to normalize, for it to make sense, for it to be actionable. So I think that the transfer there. So I know we want to talk a little bit about how things can be made equivalent to a certain degree, how we can compare more like apples to apples. They might not be the same variety of apple, but at least they're apples to apples to a certain degree. And then and how we use all of that information to make decisions, or to, you know, you look at somebody like a Kelnick who came up and has struggled. What is it that we look at in his underlying metrics that we have from major league data to say, like, okay, is he going to go the way of Keston Hura, who might just be a quadruple A player, or is this just him working out the kinks that you have when you come up. Major League Baseball is no joke. I think it's very easy for us who are on the sidelines and watching this and hearing about prospects who are so good to remember that, like, the best of the best in the world play at this level. And so even when you're making the transition from AAA, which is a ton of really, really gifted, talented, very good baseball players, you're still making a switch into a league of just the elite. And that's going to be hard. The pitchers are going to be better. They're going to be able to defend you more effectively. They're going to have your number faster. There's just a whole litany of reasons why that transition is difficult. And I think sometimes, especially as fantasy players, we just get so excited. And I'm very guilty of this, so I'm not casting stones without living in my glass house, so to speak. But we get so excited for these call-ups, and it sets us up maybe more for disappointment than anything. So how do we make sense of all this, I guess, is what that was a whole lot of words to say. and we can talk about Brandon Marsh, since that's where we started. We can move to another player. Whatever you'd like to do as the case study for why this matters, not just for these guys, but for anybody who gets called up.
Yeah, I think the easiest guys to kind of project all of this onto are going to be Brandon Marsh and Jarren Duran, who mm-hmm. are, you know, I'm not going to say they're entwined or anything like that, yeah. but, you know, they're interesting semi-mirrors of each other in terms of kind of like what we've learned about them so far. And I think that's kind of a good place to start. I am kind of partial to a lot of like the way that you'll see data just kind of like popping up in terms of like the FanGraphs big board. There's a cool thing they do there where they'll talk about like the relative risk for different guys they have. And I think that's a really good way to kind of look at this. You know, they're both pretty high up there on that prospect big board. Mm-hmm. I want to kind of just like throw a couple of other names out there just to kind of like show what sort of stuff though like we're seeing. So like when we talk about risk, almost no one gets graded as like a low risk guy.
Yeah,
there are going to be some people though who younger, maybe a little bit less developed, more toolsy, you know, like more like we see that he hit a ball really hard, we saw that he ran really fast, we saw that he reacted really quickly.
Yeah.
Versus like the guys with like just a little bit more like, yeah, this guy tore up the SEC and we drafted him and he's played pretty well. You know, mm-hmm. those right, are different right. types of guys.
Right. Definitely.
And there's a reason why Alec Bohm got drafted third overall and then made the league pretty quickly. Even if everything hasn't perfectly panned out for him, he's a guy who has like pedigree of success and has been like dominant. And that's one kind yeah. of prospect.
Right.
Whereas, for example, I want to throw out some like high risk guys towards the top of the board and kind of just talk about what they're looking at for some like them. Like, God, pretty much everyone at the top of this board is really funny because like we know very little about these guys right now.
Yeah,
that's actually a partial thing. But, you know, you might see a guy like, you know, Wander Franco, medium risk guy. Jared Kelenic, technically a medium risk guy. Mm-hmm. Adley Rutschman, medium risk guy. And then CJ Abrams, who's like the fourth guy on their board right now. That's a high risk guy. He's a little bit younger. He has not had that tearing up the SEC track.
Can he get injured as well?
I think he got some of those as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I would imagine that would affect that rating once somebody's injured at a younger age.
Yeah. So, Brandon Marsh, though, kind of fits in their medium risk scheme. And I think a lot of that comes down to the fact that, you know, he's barking on 24 years old right now. We've got some more data about him, so we kind of have a better idea based off of his actually pretty long tenures at a couple of these spots. You know, we have like a full season of AA ball from him.
Yeah,
we've seen him over time. You know, relatively speaking, we know so much about Brandon Marsh compared to some of these other guys. Whereas if you're looking at Duran, and this is a really interesting thing to me, you know, he's actually like a guy who's moved around a lot of boards this year. So you have to expand out to find him, relatively speaking. He's not sitting on the generic boards. Actually, let me click over and find that. He's like their second, third page. Look at me being all organized. I think that, though, like he represents an entirely different type of prospect. And, you know, I talked about, like, we saw that Marsh is, like, 6'4", has all that, like, frame that you can imagine. He'll get stronger one day. I don't know. Do you watch basketball?
I'm actually not a big basketball fan.
Yeah. A lot of photos have been going around about Giannis Antetokounmpo's like picture whenever he was drafted.
Mm-hmm.
He's skinny and like about 6'9" to currently where he's like, they say he's 6'11", but that's a lie. He's like basically like the Terminator or like Shaq, but fast, or however you want to describe that. He's not a real human being. Yeah. They have Durant actually also as like a medium risk guy. So okay. Just like, these are both, I want to clarify that, but I know they represent different like power potential, isn't it? Like Durant's not a guy that we thought was going to hit all the ball all the hard, and he has way more homers this year.
Yeah, so, yeah.
They're very different guys, right?
So let me stop you there for just a second so that we can maybe look at this in segments. Let's look at them as minor leaguers. What information, and we've talked about this in previous episodes to a certain degree, but what sort of information are we looking at in terms of their minor league stuff? What do we have available? How do we make those kind of judgments before they get the call? And then how do we translate that maybe to what they might do at the major league level?
Yeah. So now I started out with those grades. I'm not going to use those grades a whole lot else for this year though, because like, honestly, they are projecting long-term, hoping for growth, hoping for coaching. And that happens in the off season. That right, happens right. While you're there. Once your head is above water, so to speak, and you're just kind of like barely swimming at the major league level, you're just fighting to survive. You're not necessarily working on your game in the same way. It's kind of like a reality. You see a lot of pitchers that tend to just throw whatever keeps them around, not necessarily work on developing that changeup that would probably help put them over the top. So that's not like so much the same, I imagine, for hitters where hit ball is kind of your job. But you know, if you want to change your approach, that's going to happen more in the offseason.
Right. If you decide you want to try and hit for more power, or you're going to try and make more contact or loft or, yeah, launch angle, all that stuff. I'm sure that's not a game-to-game kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I love to call it loft separately just because it sounds like I'm keeping all of those old heads off balance, of which you are not one, I think. So congrats, I think. Yeah, the sort of things I'm gonna look for though, very very quickly, are the sorts of things that I know I can believe in, that are based off of choices, for the most part. That's strikeouts and walk numbers.
Okay.
So let's take a look at Marsh, for example. This year in AAA, he's been striking out 26.4% of the time, with a 14.5% walk rate. That's like 60% of the time putting the ball into play, 40% of the time letting the ump decide where you go. You're going. Well, I guess you can swing through it too.
Right.
So that usually happens. You usually get high strikeout and high walk if you're a guy who's a little bit choosy.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have more than a few kind of fast and choosy guys out there, because, you know, they don't want to just ground permanently. I don't know. You'll actually find that a lot of the guys we consider as like high contact guys,
yeah,
do have a bit of a called strike problem. So I'm really interested to see some of the data for him about that. It's just kind of like a whole separate thing. The power hasn't really been there though. His ISO this year is sitting at 213, quite a few doubles. I think we can scroll down and get his, like, he's got of his 24 hits in AAA this year, what is that, 5 doubles, 3 triples, and 3 home runs. Just 13 singles. So yeah, he's definitely getting something out of his power. So that's kind of where we see the power projection. It's gonna be doubles and triples sort of guy for now. Right. If you're picking him up in redraft, does that help you? Probably not. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Are there any leagues where like doubles and triples really help all that much?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it depends upon your format. If you're in a points league, it does, but you know, if you're talking about a very small sample size there as well. So let's talk a little bit about the translation, because I think that there are some tools that help us try and understand minor league stats as major league equivalents, or even like league to league equivalents.
That's literally the word. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So there are a couple of different people who are in the business of translating minor league stats to major league equivalents. Literally the word we would use. It's quite handy. Clave Davenport is so Davenport translations. You ever heard those before? We can basically just take someone's existing data, overlay some like shuffling around based off of what we know about what league you're in, etc., etc. And there's a couple different things, but the one I'm gonna kind of quote here is just kind of like the generic translation for him. So like, for example, Brandon Marsh has a 255 batting average. We can translate That's like the major league equivalent of batting .237.
Okay.
Batting average, obviously, all caveats aside, but you can kind of see like roughly how those sorts of things kind of tend to pan out. So yeah, he's not someone that you're necessarily projecting would have been doing a lot. So they his three home runs, that would have been worth about two major league home runs. Great translation there. So yeah, I think there's a lot of and I think this is kind of like where I want to say, like, you don't always have to go so far as to go to Clay Davenport's website. If you're seeing that someone has, and this is the quick and dirty stuff I'm often doing, like for Brandon Marsh, he's got a 105 WRC plus in AAA. He's been 5% better than average in the top minor league stop.
Yeah.
Does that sound like a dominant major league hitter?
No, not at all.
It doesn't. So there's definitely a good chance that Marsh is going to play plus defense, be a warm body in the Angels outfield, literally just please help them put some players into their lineup. They need help. And also, you know, he's getting up there in age. So like, it'd be interesting to see, like, if he's going to be able to play with good enough defense, if he's going to make good decisions on the base paths, maybe he just needs to see some major league pitching.
Sure.
Because the power will come. But he's not a guy I'm interested in all that much in fantasy right now.
Let me ask you this question then. How does a guy like that, and maybe you don't know, and that's fine too. You can just say, thanks for putting me on the spot and making me feel dumb, Matt. But how does a guy like that then be the 15th ranked prospect going into the season?
I want to say, like, he hasn't had a great AAA stop, but remember his AA stop in 2019, he was 40% better than the average.
Okay.
And we project the power will come because of what his frame looks like. He just hasn't added all that strength yet. Baseball takes longer. So those are the sorts of things. You add up the value that he's providing when he's not at the plate, and he's a whole lot better of a prospect then. He's definitely, I think, though, not the sort of guy that fits into the classic mold of like, you can just see that dude's going to put it all together. And I think that makes him kind of very outside of the sorts of guys I'm used to, like, seeing eight minor league clips of, looking at their minor league stat sheet really quickly. A lot of this exercise we're kind of running through, what should we care about most, is, I feel like, a lot of projecting onto, like, what each of us have gleaned from other people. I think a lot of the more interesting thing, though, is, like, as soon as we start to get a picture of him at the major league level, we're getting all this data that what a prospects people just really wish they had. I'm not accusing anyone of lying about saying they know more than they do, because like, you watch actual game film and you have experience with like who people are, like, you learn more. But we're gonna learn so much more about Brandon Marsh in the next couple weeks we've known for a long time,
and that's a good segue into what are the things we should be looking for out of Marsh and Duran as they continue in the majors. Now they're here. So everything they do is tracked. It's all put on FanGraphs. We have a ton more information. What of that information is going to be helpful in the short term, and then what becomes helpful in maybe the longer term as the season comes to an end in a couple of months?
So I'm actually going to kind of shift some focus here to Duran, because I'm very interested in some funny things that have come about him popping up in his like tinier than tiny sample Savant stuff. He has 13 PA so far.
Yeah.
I don't know anything that's good sample wise in 13 PA.
Right.
So one of the things that's shown up is he's struck out 38.5% of the time so far. Again, just laughable that could even mean anything. That's do you know how many strikeouts that is
out of 13 at bats? I mean, out of 3 or 4.
Five.
Obviously talking about very small things. So I guess my question isn't, if I go to the FanGraphs page right now, what's meaningful?
Clearly,
but
clearly,
like, as he gets to 30 and 50 and approaches 100, if I'm really trying to evaluate him for whatever reason, whether it's fantasy, whether it's just general interest, whether it's, he gets involved. I don't think this is going to happen, but he's involved in a trade. What are the things that we want to look at again? Like, what's going to happen? What's going to be the quickest path to having good information? What's going to normalize first? And how can we then compare that to what he's done in the minors to have this like narrative meets data? Here's the most likely outcome for him.
Oh, yeah, for sure. There's a bunch of things that are really easy to use right away. And some of them for him are actually kind of funny already. So again, think about like what is most in his control. What is based off a choice he's making or is a pure expression of how skilled he is? I'm looking, before I even look at his like strikeout rate, then things are going to normalize even faster are going to be things like his zone contact rate.
Yep.
His chase rate and his chase contact rate to a degree. But like zone contact and chase are like, how often do you hit the pitches you should be like hitting in the zone when you're swinging?
Yep.
And how often are you choosing to lay off? Those things are for him not like actually look really good in his tiny sample, yeah. Despite the good strikeout rate. So yeah, he's 82% in zone contact. One of the nice things about Savant is you can actually just go and see league average. That is a third of a percent better than league average. But for a guy that you would hope is going to make a lot of contact to get most of his speed, pretty good. Right. His chase rate. The league average chase rate is 28.3%. It's pretty good. His zone swing rate is a little bit lower so far. Again, this is all just kind of like blindly blowing smoke at some tiny numbers, but like you can go and you can see how these are going to go over the next.
Well, and that's the thing is what numbers we look at now and say, okay, it's a small sample size. This is meaningless, but in a couple of weeks might be more meaningful.
And I want to say like for those particular numbers, because they are so based upon choice and also because the PAs will rack up, we're talking once he's at 75, 80 plate appearances, we'll have a pretty good guess at who he is.
Mm-hmm.
That's talking like by the time we hit the trade deadline, we're going to know like a fair amount about kind of like first iteration Jaron Durant. And then people are going to start throwing him different stuff in different places. And the relative mixes of those are going to be what matters. But how often he's making contact when he swings in the zone will probably stay pretty steady. How often he's choosing to swing will actually be something to watch. You know, is he choosing to lay off? Once you get those sorts of things, that's where things like, and sometimes I hate it, but things like hard hit rate are going to start to matter within about 100 PAs as well. We'll start to get a measure of how consistently he's tapping into power. By the way, he's already started like hitting the ball pretty hard. Of the eight, I guess it is seven or eight balls that he's already put into play. Yeah, he's walked once, struck out five times. So he's got seven balls in play so far. God, that's just so funny. I'm still having a lot of fun with it. He's got a 71.4% hard hit rate. That's five hard hit balls already, though. That's really good. And that's even better when you think about it that in the context of all its stats. 5 out of 13 as like a hard hit per PA rate. Again, a quarter is lead of average for that. So he's already in just like his first couple of games, like even though he's had a couple strikeouts, the results have been there. Let's check in again. I'm saying there's 60, 70 PAs. We'll start to have like a, we're going to have a pretty good picture of like where the wobble range is going to be within 100 to 150. That's who he's probably going to be for the rest of the year.
Yeah, right.
So I would say mid-August, I mean, don't expect him to change radically at that point. So that's really, really fun. Also, like other things like, you know, it takes a little while before your like max exit velo is like telling of what who you could be. But he's already put one into play. It's about 107 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. If you can get that over 110, that's going to be pretty good for a guy we thought was just fast.
Right,
and
right.
And then for his sprint speed, like, give that a week or two and we'll probably get a chance to see what his peak could be. So I'm super excited about him. And I think this is really important to say because he's such a good example of the power just showed up and we have no other option but to believe that it's probably real.
Yeah.
Cause you can't fake that.
Right.
And that's that like sort of, you can't fake it sort of thing is one of the most interesting things. So, you can't fake, by the way, if we're looking at a couple other guys who are not these guys who have showed up early on in the year, you can't fake the kind of dominance Jared Kelnick has had at levels that are not Major League Baseball.
Yeah, right,
and that's the sort of thing that I think a lot of people are kind of leaning on right now. What sort of exceptional stuff have you provided? What have you done that's well above what could be random chance? And it seems like Duran's done just so much of that already this year in terms of, like, growth in power. Mm-hmm. And we're already starting to see like for a guy, he's 6'2". He's not tiny.
Right, right.
But I think it's easy to think of him that way because he's fast. These people are going to do some impressive things. We should pay attention.
Before we move on from this segment, are there any other players that you want to talk about? Maybe they fall into that category we kind of dismissed at the beginning, at the top. People who kind of came up last year and are still rookie eligible, but players in general that maybe are on the other side of where Duran and Marsh are now, that mm-hmm. we can kind of look at and say, you know, look at what Jess Chisholm has done, or Jonathan India, people who are a little further along in their call ups.
Yeah, those are two guys that I'm really interested in kind of paying attention to. And, you know, I feel like there are going to be some cases where it's like the data that we have is just really weird. Like, I am so fascinated by the choices that Akil Badu has made this year. He looks really fun and really good.
Yeah.
We don't have like a strong, like, he had a long run in AAA that's giving us a lot of information, sort of like situation in the same way. Same thing for like Adolis Garcia. If we're looking towards the top of like the rookie outcomes leaderboards, you want to say, oh, yeah, how good was this guy? How good is he now? Those guys aren't people we have a ton of data for. But let's go to Jazz Chisholm's page. And like, we can pull him together. All right, yeah. So taking a look at Jazz Chisholm's page. And yes, he's injured right now. It's terrible. He was supposed to be playing at the Marlins-Nats game I was at on Monday night that ended at like 18-1 for the Nats. I personally believe he could have scored 17 runs and changed the outcome of that game.
Sure.
Yeah, but Jazz Chisholm had posted strikeout rates, double A in 2019, 25%. That was for like for Miami. For Arizona, he was in like the 30s at both high A and double A. So he was able to cut that down. And then, you know, you add a couple extra points when he gets called up, essentially. And he was back at 30%, five higher than he was at his last highest stop. So it's like, you can project that. You know, he was sitting at like a WRC plus numbers, 150 at two different stops for like a good number of plate appearances and stuff like that. And then like 120 for his much longer Arizona AA spot. So then in the majors, you adjust that down. He's at a 110 WRC plus this year. Mm. So like, it's not like it's an easy, like, add 5% more strikeouts or cut someone's WRC plus like 30 points. But, you know, you're going to be able to confidently predict that that's going to be a year average sort of like outcome for him. And that's what's cool about this is like when someone goes and dominates, you expect within a season or so, you might see an above average MLB season. So it'd be really fun to see then Jaron Duran put up a slightly above average rest of season outcome, and then we can just salivate next February and just think, can this guy go 30-30? I don't know if he can go 30-30, but do you remember what we were projecting for like Kevin Biggio to get him into like the top 50 picks?
Yeah,
like we're just gonna lose our minds over Jaron Duran next spring. Well, he's just average,
especially if he keeps doing exciting things. Recency bias is a thing. There's no way around it. No matter how often we talk about numbers and all those things, somebody who really impressed us, people really want to be the one who has that guy when he takes off and blows up. They really do. So it's okay. It's okay if that's you. Sometimes it's me.
Now, here's the part where I feel obligated to ask you. How well does the homer cap fit right now for Jaron Duran for you?
Well, yeah, I mean,
are you ready to wear it?
As a Sox fan, it's hard. I actually do really try very hard with my fantasy stuff and with what we do here to separate out being a Red Sox fan. But of course, when you're a fan of a team and they get a guy who comes up and he's electric and exciting, especially with what the Sox have done this year, which is the complete opposite of everything I thought they were going to be at the beginning of the year. Of course it's exciting and it's fun. And, you want them to do well. You really do. All right, let's move into a pass fail segment. And we're actually going to commit some more time in this episode to our pass fail and our off the books segments, topics definitely worthy of discussion. And I since we're doing it as pass fail, I'm going to put it to you this way, but this warrants far more discussion than just giving me the straight pass fail response right off the bat. And that's talking about the situation with the Oakland A's and the stadium and the new stadium they want, question mark. Maybe they don't. Why don't we talk a little bit about that? And if you wouldn't mind just kind of kicking off a little bit of telling everybody what's going on, just in case they're not up on the news.
So I'm going to start by being a little bit obnoxious. The Oakland Athletics don't want to play in what we call the Oakland Coliseum anymore. I think that's not news to anyone.
Mm.
Anything more complicated than that, though, I feel like is when we start to actually getting... There are going to be some situations where people like me are going to project on kind of like how I feel like you have to interpret the data about how ownership and ownership outside of baseball as well tends to interact in these places, and how city councils and other people are kind of like incentivized to act. So we're in a situation where the Oakland A's billionaire inheritor owner, who by the way inherited the Gap fortune. Yes. Are you someone who
has Fisher access to it?
That's I don't know how you want to put that exactly, but that's where he got his money. I don't want to say made his money. Someone else made that company, and a lot of other workers have produced the money that makes that money company exist.
Right.
So yeah, that's where he comes from, and he wants his team to play somewhere else. They have that Oakland Coliseum site where they could just redevelop the stadium. I'm not saying like improvements. They could put something else there.
Yeah.
They don't want to do that. And the reporting seems to be right now, I believe Manfred was effectively like on a Sirius XM radio and said something to the effect of like the team sees it is more profitable to use that site for like housing.
Hmm.
So they've picked out another location in town called Howard Terminal. I'm not someone like extremely familiar with all of the geography of Oakland and the Bay Area, but still just
I'm zero else. Familiar it's with
really
it,
kind
so,
of like
yeah.
all you need to know essentially here. Probably not exclusively. There's probably a lot of interesting stuff on the ground about like these localities and like the history of those properties and like who lives there. But even without that,
mm-hmm.
just the general piece of information is the team sees it as more profitable to turn that into housing. And they're asking for the city to pay a whole lot of money to help them develop Howard Terminal into the number that we're seeing is like $12 billion is what they want
right.
to go into this entire site between them and the city to put a stadium, parking, shopping, food, and just to make it the place to be as they wish it to be. Now, I don't know how many places to be have actually been like fully utopian built out of a baseball, football, basketball stadium ever. But it's a whole lot of projecting and... I hired an architect to make me happy that comes from the ownership side and those sorts of things. So should that not happen, because there are not 32 teams, there are some empty cities that are willing to be act as like places that you can say will give you money. So yep. the Oakland A's, it sounds like because of the way that they are saying they're reacting, how the city's negotiating with them, may become the Las Vegas A's.
Las Vegas Athletics. Doesn't really roll off the tongue.
There's already Las Vegas Aces too in the AAA world as well, so it's just even doubly.
Yeah. So let's take a look at this if you don't mind from kind of the two different points of view. I mean, there's obviously the cynical view of, you know, the billionaire has the assets and is going to make more money off of this, and who does that hurt? Does it hurt the fan? Does it hurt the people on the ground? There's also the other way of looking at it that, okay, so they developed the Coliseum area into high rise condos, people pay a lot of money for them. They go develop this other place that's not being used for that. It employs people. It brings maybe extra tourists into the city. It there's got to be a vested interest in the city for approving. I think they called it a term sheet, right? So we know that the city council
like
has
what we're going to negotiate with. Yeah, and here's the things we
has
want
approved
to say,
a but... term sheet. That's worth $12 billion. I think that the frustration on the athletic side is that's a term sheet that's got different terms than they wanted approved on that sheet. I think somewhere in there, and I'll put the links to some articles in the show notes. I think that the real sticking point is about somewhere around $350 million and who's kind of covering that, the city or the ownership group. You know, there, but there's got to be a reason that the city would want to do this and want to be a partner on a $12 billion project that's not putting money in their pockets per se. So what are the two sides of this, I guess, if we're going to look at it from maybe the positive spin and the cynical spin?
So, yeah, I think you kind of raise like the there has to be some amount of this that's true with like regard to someone has to benefit a little bit from a new stadium being built.
Right.
And I like to make sure that like, we talk about like the costs and the benefits and also just kind of like the ways that those also just get off track whenever we're outside of like the pristine reality that happens in like the CGI stadium flyover tours. Yeah. That the A's tweeted out about what they think their new stadium could be. Yeah. Howard Terminal is like I'm trying to see here. It looks like it's about like 4 or 5 miles west of and like kind of like northwest of where the Coliseum currently is. It's closer to like closer to Alameda, I guess, is
waterfront, right?
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. It looks like it would be a really cool idea if money were fake and stuff like that. So I want to say the geography of that, we're going to really embarrass ourselves here. The bigger idea, though, is it's a big, pristine, pretty location that does seem like it would be a good spot, potentially, to park a bunch of cars and put a bunch of shopping. Mm-hmm. The question, though, is if Oakland's taxpayers are going to be putting in something on the range of, you know, 10, 20... $30 million a year over the course of 15, 20 years. That's a considerable investment that could be going towards other things. Right. And the question then is like, why are we paying this money? Are you paying this money because it makes you better off? Or are you paying this money because you feel like there's a threat your team will move? I think there is a pretty good way to kind of look at these is like, if you view sports teams as I kind of do as like, community like general properties, which isn't true, by the way,
right?
The,
not legally
Oakland
speaking,
A's are not a community property, but I kind of like decide to view them that way anyway because a lot of people see them as like a public good.
I think you can look at it that way in terms of understanding the motivations of the fans or the taxpayers.
You know, it's almost like you know, you can imagine that there's like a just some sort of like historic but for-profit thing that everyone has just decided they like, and in the interest of we all like this service they provide, we should keep it there even if it means someone gets some money at the end of the day. I think that there's kind of like that's how our world works, and I think that like there's a lot of cynicism you can have, but like at the end of the day, like I like to go to my local Target and I give them money and I buy things and it makes me happy. And baseball teams are like that but much bigger.
Right.
I don't know. There are a lot of targets, though.
Well, I think one of the biggest distinctions, though, that we have to make when we're having this discussion is, you know, Target, they might have some leverage in a city or a town to say, we're going to buy this space and we're going to put one of our stores here as opposed to the next town over. But a Major League Baseball team, baseball is a monopoly. It's not like that's not just a theoretical thing. They have been granted monopoly status, separate from the antitrust laws that exist in this country. And so the leverage that a team has when they're the only like Major League Baseball league, right, that exists, you're not getting the same leverage from an independent league team, I guess is what I'm saying. When I mean, I don't know, to me it almost feels like they're using this status that the federal government has granted them to kind of push and bully people around. And whether that's good business and you're fine with that, like that's not what I'm getting at. You can think that that's horrible. You can think that that's just the way it is and that's what capitalism is all about and that's how this country works and so be it. But it certainly holds the fans of an area hostage. You know, like how many people are going to stand up and say, I love my local team? Let's make this about the Yankees for a second. Let's do that. Let's separate it from the Athletics. How many Yankee fans are going to say, I think your economics are bad. I'm going to let you move and become a Mets fan or a Red Sox fan?
God forbid,
Well, I think that goes back to what you were saying in terms of it being a public good. It clearly is not a public good from a legal and financial standpoint. But from a fan base and a loyalty point of view, I think people are going to be a lot more willing to swallow bad economic policy, even in their own interests, because they're fans. Like, somebody who might want the A's to stay and are rooting for this thing to go through might wind up with less funding for their own housing or benefits if they lose their job. Like, that's real, because that's real money that's going from the city to this stadium instead of to goods and services for the people of the city who are paying into those coffers. So, I mean, there's a ton of moving parts, but I do think it's important to acknowledge that this is a monopoly, and that gives them so much power and influence. And on top of that, that fan loyalty is going to let them get away with even more than some other business.
Yep. I think this is where we kind of have to pull this back into like the specific reality of where we're at, right? You can make that Yankees comparison, but a lot of the discussion that I think is kind of like happening around the A's is the fact that they don't draw much attendance. People don't like to go to it. It's not the O.co Coliseum anymore. I actually don't even know its current name. I just know it's not that. And the question then becomes, it's like, well, they're not getting any fans. We got to do something. I guess this thing the team says that they have to do must be true then. And that's just not how things work. John Fisher's worth like $3 and change billion. That's probably gone up. Mm-hmm. He hasn't made any of that money personally himself. And he has probably, I would say, a considerable capacity to make a good, sound decision about the team financing some things. He puts in some money. And the team decides to put in some money based off of what, or the city decides to put in some money, state, local things. That's not where we're at right now, though. Someone is playing, like, let's go make a big, beautiful thing that is a monument to my success that I perceive. That's what's happening here. Yeah. That's why you dream up their Howard Terminal thing rather than choosing to make the prudent financial decision. John Fisher has also run the Oakland A's financially, you know, in a way that, like, defines our understanding of them. That is definitely a team that if they had been choosing to invest long term would not be in this position where they're at with fans.
Yeah,
this is a team that, like, if they had not chosen essentially to not do things differently with the Coliseum, you know, potentially, you know, there's lots of things they could have been doing to maintain.
Well, I mean, there was a report,
a whole lot better for a whole long, for a very long time.
Yeah, a report from, or a quote, I should say, from somebody who gave it on condition of anonymity because they work for the guy, that appears in this article that, again, I'll put in the show notes, where he basically walked into a room and a lot of people had never seen him. He keeps kind of a low profile and basically said, yeah, I know I'm the cheapest owner in baseball, or something to that effect, right? So he's acknowledging this. I mean, I have made no secret of how I feel about the business of baseball interfering with the on-field product and how much it really stinks. And, you know, somebody who's already got $3 billion, I mean, to me, they've won. You won. You're good. Spend some money on the baseball team if you are really into baseball. Sell the team to somebody who wants a good on-field product if you don't. You don't need to earn any more money. You have what you need. Now, I guess when you get up to that level, whatever. And who am I to tell him what to do with his money and his life? But it's hard for me to swallow the idea that this whole thing is causing turmoil and angst. And, you know, the city council is having to allocate funds to all of this. To what end? I mean, like you said, a monument to his wealth, to his power, to his prestige. And quite honestly, you know, if they're having a hard time drawing fans because of the way his team is running, and part of that, a large part of that, has to do with how he's funding that team, you're really gambling that people are going to come, you know, on the Field of Dreams mantra, right? If you build it at Howard's Landing, they will come. Maybe they still won't, because the product you're providing them is subpar in their eyes. So, I mean, it's a huge risk too, to invest all that money. You don't know that necessarily that means people are going to show up and be willing to watch the same team in a different place.
Yeah. Let's also talk about some of the other things there that I think are really important. You bring up selling the team. So, like, they don't, and they're still the team that's run currently the way they are, that is getting rid of talent left and right every year.
Mm-hmm.
Marcus Semien is, like, clearly the best second baseman in the American League right now after not playing second base at all. And like looks like he is like a down ballot MVP candidate again after being that 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. They just let him walk because they didn't want to sign him. And what do they do to replace him? If you were to say nothing, I think that would be accurate, except instead of nothing, they have Elvis Andrews, mm-hmm. Which has been kind of worse than that. And they're going to repeat this process again. I mean, it's really fun for me to tune in and watch Matt Olson hit home runs into the right field and center field empty seats mm-hmm. in the Coliseum.
But he won't be an A for much longer.
I would project that there is not a Matt Olson extension that I will care about. And if there is, I'm going to be surprised.
Yeah.
Like, that's just kind of like, that's the default setting. I don't know anything at all about how they prioritize him or what he prioritizes. That's just the gamble we can take. Now, if he does sell the team, this is really important as well. The only thing that's really changing the value of the team is a thing like that stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And he is going to gain value out of this that he's going to be able to cash in on. And this is where another piece that's really important kind of comes in. That's a ProPublica piece that many people have dove into in terms of sports and money. Basically explores how sports league owners, not just baseball, can use what is a loophole that the MLB helped lobby for during mm-hmm. The early 2000s to allow like their baseball teams or football teams or basketball teams to be treated as depreciating, like value losing
right,
assets.
Right.
So if he's able to get this stadium built, he can, for his next 15, like if he sells to someone else almost immediately after the fact, that new someone else can treat the new stadium that gets built as an asset that is going down in value for the next 15 years, along with any new contracts they might hand out to Matt Olson or whoever else.
Right.
Despite
right.
the fact that that's just blatantly not true.
Well, right.
Teams are
so,
going up in value.
And this is the off the book segment, just to clarify that, and talking about billionaires using their sports franchises for tax breaks. And, you know, as the article states it, and correct me if I'm wrong in my understanding and reading of this, when you buy something new, let's say it's a business that has,
let's say we're running a restaurant, right? And you buy like a new, like a stove thing for your kitchen, right?
Like that does depreciate. Or if you have,
yes.
If you are running an oil delivery company and you have a fleet of trucks, those depreciate. The facilities depreciate, right? The machinery, the whatever it is, that most assets do depreciate in value. You buy them new; they're the most expensive when they're new, and then they lose value, and you're allowed to write that off on your taxes. Fine, that's the way that it is. With sports franchises,
yeah, actually, I had no problem with that for restaurants.
Yeah, right. With sports franchises, though, they're basically treating television contracts, player contracts, and things that really do not depreciate as though they do. I think yes. we have a lot of evidence to show that sports franchises do not depreciate over time. As a matter of fact, most of the money that is made by buying and selling. So even if year over year you show a net loss, your franchise is still worth more and more money. You see this when they get sold. So you're able to write that off. And I just for context, in this piece, they showed that somebody working at the stadium who made, I think it was somewhere around $53,000 a year, wound up paying a tax rate of 14.1%. This was the Clippers organization that they used.
So it's owned by Steve Ballmer.
Yeah.
Microsoft exec.
A player wound up, you know, spending $38 million in taxes. So it had a 36% tax rate because of how much he made. And the owner who's paying all that money, the owner who's the billionaire, paid less than the woman who made 53 grand in percentage. Now, it's a big number, but as a percentage of his income, it was less than what the person making 53 grand a year paid. So I that's what we're talking about here. And are those assets actually depreciating?
Yeah, and I think the final piece of this puzzle that's especially bringing it back to sports, if that's where your values lie still fundamentally, yeah. Is that these write-offs then get placed into the balance sheet as net negatives, because that's what you have to do for the accounting to make sense for your taxes. Right. It's like, I'm writing this off, I'm taking a loss, because wink, wink, nudge, nudge, the value of Fernando Tatis's contract is going up. Literally, player contracts.
Right.
That's one of their things that they view as depreciating assets. For wink, wink, nudge, nudge, all of this money that I've decided to pay out for Fernando Tatis is going to depreciate, and he's going to become less valuable, and I need to make sure that... And that's how you end up in a world where the revenues put the team as losing money. And then when the league needs to go to the negotiating table, or when the Oakland A's go to the negotiating table, they say, yeah, we're losing money.
Right.
When that's just blatantly not true.
And not the way that they discuss when they're at the negotiating table with the new buyer. Yeah. Right. And certainly people are not buying franchises for more than the other guys spend if they've spent 10 years losing money. It just doesn't make sense. Yeah.
Now, the particulars of this, I don't know if they do apply for Oakland, I should say, necessarily, because I need to figure out when John Fisher bought the team, but it's a 15-year window. When did John Fisher buy the team? So John Fisher bought, finished buying out the last stake that he bought in November of 2016. And kind of like buying shares of it and over time prior to that. And like, he's been a principal owner for quite a while. But the way these laws work is you basically get to write something off when you buy it for 15 years. So like Ballmer bought the Clippers, you know, he's going to have a couple more years of being able to write them off before he can't do that anymore. But you'll see a lot of these teams trade hands kind of increasingly frequently. You see this kind of works like a lot of, you'll see like people like be like a minority investor in a team and they buy like 5% and they keep that around for a little while. And they use that to say that they're not, that they're losing money.
Right.
And then they sell it. Someone else who gets to pull the same trick. So it's really important to understand, I think, that if we do see these sports teams as what we would like to be public goods, as what we would like to be pillars of the community, if we would like to see them run in those sorts of ways where, you know, they promote youth sports and they promote like sportsmanship and they promote all these other things that are important. You know, you see things like John Wall when he was here in D.C., constantly a fixture of the community, constantly showing up to like hand out backpacks to kids, or you know, people looked up to him because he's a good dude, right? If that's what you want your sports to be, the tax code surrounding this and the way that the sports have been financialized creates a scenario where that is not what they are incentivized to do. So all of the everything that I think we could normally say about like hoarding a bunch of wealth meaning that someone else doesn't, you know, like think about like the minor league players, like even just like put it in those terms, if that's as narrow as you can think about this, like Gavin Lux, when he was tearing up AAA and AA, is getting paid basically nothing.
Right.
And someone else, like several someone's else as part of the ownership group, are being able to use his, like his, the team that he's going to someday play for as a way to not pay taxes.
Right.
And amass more money. It's evil,
the flip
right?
side, like, yeah, the flip side of this obviously is, well, it's not illegal. They're not breaking the law, so they're just being smart businessmen, and this is what they're doing and how they're using it. I think the problem is, and you know, this probably is true not just of sports, but people who buy and sell companies, and you know, the line workers there. You're really impacting actual people's lives. It's not just dollars and cents on a balance sheet. So I get the argument that, like, look, if they can make more money selling the Coliseum land to developers and sell off, you know, huge high priced condos and go develop this ballpark somewhere else, and they can get the city government to pay for some of it, and everybody thinks it's a great idea, why in the world would they not? I think you really have to find somebody who understands the impact on the people and values that. And you know, I mean, it remains to be seen what's going to happen in Oakland, but I do think that a lot of times the guys that are up that high, right, that are billionaires, it is an unbelievable amount of money. You know, you generally don't get there without spending a lot of time looking at balance sheets and understanding the smart move and making the move regardless of consequences to others. And I don't mean to say that they're all evil people. I just mean, I think that's just the way you accumulate that kind of wealth. So you know, I guess that's the flip side, is why shouldn't they do it if they can? But it really stinks to put, you know, fans in the middle or a city council in the middle, or having to divert funds from real social programs that benefit real people on the ground to build a stadium or a vanity project or something to that effect.
Yeah. I think the better question is not like, why shouldn't they? It's like, why should we allow that to be a possibility?
Yeah.
And further, it's just like that's like just strictly the tax code. Why should we allow the tax code to work this way? Why should we allow like cities to have to operate this way? But, you know, broaden that out also just a hair larger. It's like, why should we be happy with this being the way that our sport is run as well? Yeah, people like us who care about these institutions because it's fun.
Yeah.
Should be willing to see that, like, in order to care about baseball, you have to care about this. It's a take that I feel like I constantly have to like explain. It's like, you can't access and really understand everything that happens in our game. You can't understand why the Oakland A's aren't going to make the playoffs this year. You can't understand why the Angels have been bad for a long time. Now that's like a like vanity project mismanagement rather than just money mismanagement. Yeah. People say it's related but not the same. Like, you can't understand why teams are the way that they are. You can't without like being willing to take a look a little bit at how the sausage gets made.
Sure.
And if, that can make people very uncomfortable.
Yeah. I think that the example you bring up about minor leaguers, though, really, it really underscores what's going on there. I saw this, it was a report a couple of days ago about, and I forget the franchise, it might've even been the Athletics, but that their minor leaguers, hotel bills when they were, away cost them more than they were actually making. And they had no choice because there weren't host families. And I know COVID has been a big thing, but you're talking about, those are the people that are going to cut, not all of them, obviously, but they're going to come up into your system. And they're the ones that are creating this product and driving all this money to you. And like just the,
it was the A's.
Yeah. Yep. So we're talking about the Oakland Athletics here investing billions of dollars in a new stadium, and their minor leaguers are forced to pay hotel bills that exceed their earnings. It's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. I think that maybe instead of a vanity stadium project, maybe you take care of your minor leaguers first. You know, I mean, you're talking about somebody with $3 billion. It's just, I don't know. Yeah. That's where I start to actually get fired up. And this isn't a soapbox for me to stand on here. So I'm going to get off of it. But that's where I think you really get to see the juxtaposition of what's going on here.
So I think this kind of leads us to what I think is like the one last question that we should probably leave here thinking about, because I don't think we're able to answer it properly. And that is, if you're an Oakland A's fan, what do you do?
Yeah.
I think I've started to kind of confront that with the Orioles to a degree. Peter Angelos, their owner, is actually in a lot of like non-baseball ways been a person who has done things that are good for the people of Maryland, the people of Baltimore. He's old and his son is like about to fully take over. And I cannot say the same thing of his son, who is like the executive at Masson. Do you know anything about how well Masson is run right now?
I don't, but the smile on your face suggests all I need to know.
Yeah. So I'm not excited for the reality where that could be the case, or someone else might buy them as an institution and try to transform them, because I just want to imagine that that is a bunch of people who play baseball at Camden Yards, which is a beautiful place, by the way, which didn't cost $4 billion. And let other people get in on things once in a while as well. So if you're an Oakland A's fan, and there are alarmingly few of them, given how cool the city of Oakland is and how great their colors are, Memphis Depay, who's a Dutch soccer player who's about to start playing for Barcelona, posted this really funny like workout video the other day where he wasn't actually working out and he was wearing an Oakland A's hat.
Oh, nice.
And it was a beautiful one as well. It's like one of the colors a little more exaggerated, and you really get some of the nice mustard into the yellow. Mm. Great, great hat. And it's like, I don't think he's an Oakland A's fan. He really cares. But, you know, like they are a franchise that I think I wish we had an alternate reality where we could love them more.
Yeah.
And well, I just do. If I were a supporter of them, I would not know what to do with myself.
Yeah, I think it's really hard. But I also think it's easy maybe for the rest of us who are not to absolve ourselves because our team's not in the spotlight right now, but this stuff happens with all of them, whether it's TV rights or negotiations, the MLB blackouts on MLB TV, all of this, all of the stuff that's going on across the league. It's a sport-wide problem, and it manifests in different ways and in different places, but it's certainly, they're all symptoms of the same kind of underlying disease.
Yeah. Yeah. It's important to remember Rob Manfred doesn't just appear out of midair. The decisions that he makes that support ownership don't just happen out of midair. He's appointed by and he serves ownership to continue them as a business organization. And baseball is not the MLB. I hope someone gets annoyed by the MLB after all this time we've been yelling about other stuff. But yeah, I think the, like, us just kind of talking about the financialization being evil is one thing. I think that we probably do need to make sure that we kind of give some care to, like, that question of, like, what it means to be a good fan and, like, an angry fan at the right times. Mm-hmm. And a celebrating fan when things are worth celebrating.
Right, absolutely.
You know, it's like, the league doesn't universally always do really terrible things. I think in the past year or so, they've done a great job, actually, of helping players kind of take the reins on promoting themselves, which has been really cool. You know, we're seeing so much of Tatis and Otani that's just from Tatis and Otani, basically just, hey, look at these dudes doing their thing.
Yeah.
And I like that. I don't want to say just like there's a thing that has happened that's been good. And I think that's a nice reminder that the best things in baseball are not created by the people who write the check to build a stadium. You could build it anywhere and I would come for them. I'm not showing up because some stadium has fancy amenities.
Or the restaurant across the street has a great wine selection. I mean, maybe a handful of people, but I mean, that's not.
No, I'm showing up for Juan Soto.
Right.
I'm not showing up for anything that Mike Rizzo or anything above anyone above him has done. I'm showing up for Juan Soto.
Absolutely.
Mike Rizzo, an SGM, I guess it probably isn't the right thing. That's still player side. Yeah.
All right. Well, that does bring us to the end of this episode. I think that we talked about a lot of really meaningful stuff, a lot of important stuff, and hopefully some of these conversations continue. We'll check back in on some of these prospects with an episode later on in the season and see how things have unfolded. Thanks for being a part of this with me, as always, Alexander. And if you could just let the people know where they could find us.
Well, they can find you on Twitter at TheCorkedMatt. I'm on Twitter at Chase_Rate. And most importantly, you can find our podcast on Twitter at Dugout Study Hall, where you can send us some questions. Please be sure to subscribe to the Pitcherless podcast feed if you haven't done that already. Leave us a good review if you can be so kind. And if you're not already, please consider becoming a PL Plus member so that you can harass us on the PL Discord. And that's it for me.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll catch you next time.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Save big money and start your spring project with help from Menards. We offer a huge selection of body plants, veggies, and herbs to plant at home and grow yourself. Right now, all 4.5-inch body plants are on sale through May 5th. Head to the Menards Garden Center to get your garden growing and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.